Coming up this afternoon on Central Time, Central Wisconsinites don't agree on whether to declare they live in a community for all. The county board rejected the label, but the mayor of its largest city made the declaration. Details at 3 o'clock on the Ideas Network.
From virtual learning to remote working, high-speed internet has never been more important. Thanks to the new Federal Emergency Broadband Benefit Program, you may be eligible for a significant discount. Funds are limited. Find out if you qualify and enroll at getemergencybroadband.org. WPR, PBS Wisconsin, and the Public Service Commission of Wisconsin are proud to bring you this message. Support for WPR comes from the Wisconsin Historical Museum, presenting the stories of Wisconsin's history through artifacts and exhibits. Open Thursdays through Saturdays from 11 to 3, starting on June 3rd. WisconsinHistoricalMuseum.org.
Support also comes from Associated House Rights, a residential architecture and construction firm dedicated to thoughtful planning and enduring craftsmanship for Dane County remodeling, addition, and new home projects. HouseRights.com.
Well, I hope you've had a chance to stop and smell some spring flowers and the lilacs in these past few weeks, especially as our temperatures heat up. I enjoyed that this morning. I had a little 3-mile jog this morning, and it was just great. The lilacs, there's some lilacs in bloom in my neighborhood, and it was great, and the temperature wasn't too bad either, and temperatures are one of the things on our mind, I think, now as we visit and turn to our weather guy, Steve Ackerman, back with us, Vice Chancellor for Research and Graduate Education at UW-Madison, also a professor from the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at the UW. Steve, good to see your smiling face.
It's good to be here and talking with you, Larry. Yep, I was working in my garden this weekend, and now I'm stiff and sore. But the flowers smelled good, I will say that.
John Martin, I think, is with us. John, are you there?
Yes, I am, Larry. Nice to be with you.
John's a professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences, former chair of that department, too. So as we talk with John and Steve, what signs of spring are around you? Has this spring weather been unusual for your area? Are you worried about severe weather? What spring weather questions or observations do you have? I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Join on in. So, John and Steve, last time we had you on, there was a giant hail in Texas in the news. Now we're seeing temperatures into the 80s. May's been a little bit weird weather-wise, hasn't it?
Well, in our neck of the woods, it's been kind of weird. We had a record-setting 8 straight mornings from the 7th to the 14th of May, where the temperature was below 40 degrees Fahrenheit in Madison. That has only happened 3 other times. And so that was an unusual cold start to the month. And then, of course, everybody was thinking about 4th of July on Saturday. It felt like the 4th of July. It was hot and humid, and Steve was out doing his garden. And he's only stiff now because it's 2 days after the fact. The day of, it was, you know, sort of like the Tin Man with the oil can. He felt great because it was so hot and muggy, but not anymore.
Yeah, and then we got some good rain, too. I mean, we've been below average for the month. But, yeah, after my gardening and I went in to relax and have a Wisconsin refreshment, it rained. So it was great for that, from that aspect, too.
Yeah.
Well, it rained a bit, but I think... Yeah, I think we're over 5 inches below normal in at least in the Madison area, and
most of the state is 50% of what we normally would be getting in May in terms of precipitation.
Yeah, so we didn't have any April showers this year, and luckily we nonetheless have May flowers. We don't particularly deserve them because of the deficit in April and May that we've had. It's been a very dry period.
Yeah. Steven Sun Prairie has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Steve.
Yeah, hi, guys. Yesterday I left Sun Prairie about noonish, and and drove to Milwaukee, and I'm very close to the lakeshore in Milwaukee. The temperature had dropped almost 30 degrees. What was going on?
Yeah, that is the impact of the freshly out of winter Lake Michigan. And boy, does it make a difference at this time of year. If you get a strong lake breeze in May, you can be freezing cold right on near and on the lakefront in Milwaukee or any place else along Lake Michigan. And just a few miles inland, completely different. In fact, not only lake effect, but also some larger weather system effect brought the temperature down from the low 80s in Duluth on, I think, Friday and Saturday, or maybe just Friday, down into the 50s on Sunday. So 30 or so degrees drop sounds like the equivalent of what you saw in Milwaukee. So that is just a sign of this time of year. It'll gradually ameliorate as the summer moves in, but it's always going to be a lot cooler in Milwaukee on a day with a wind off the water, and it was especially dramatic, it sounds like, yesterday.
Yeah, Steve,
yeah,
thanks.
I was really impressed about the forecast for that. So a couple of days before it occurred, I saw people on Twitter and the National Weather Service at Milwaukee were pointing this out, that it was going to be occurring. So I was pretty impressed by the forecast.
Yeah, that is remarkable, isn't it? Yep.
Steve, thank you from Sun Prairie. Appreciate it very much. Fred in Menominee, Wisconsin, it's your turn. What's on your mind?
Well, hi, everybody. This winter, of course, we heard a lot about the polar vortex. And I watched my favorite weather channel is the NOAA thing on the computer. And it looked, when we got this cold in the beginning of this month, I thought, that just looks like the polar vortex happening again. Was it? And is it, I presume it is still affecting our weather as we're going along?
Well, we can safely say at this stage of the year that the actual polar vortex, not the media-created hysterical thing that the people talked about the last few years when it gets cold, is gone. It's a seasonal thing. It goes from about October until about mid-April or so on average. Sometimes it leaves earlier, sometimes a little bit later. But that actual stratospheric polar vortex is now disintegrated. It disappears when the sun comes up and starts to warm the atmosphere in the high latitudes. The fact that we were cold in May is just sort of a residual of how much cold air has remained at high latitude without being modified by particularly abundant sunshine or long days or anything like that. And maybe it's been extra cloudy at high latitude. I honestly don't know what some of those factors may have been. And then only specified targets at the middle latitudes will actually be the recipients of the last vestiges of that wintertime cold air. And this year we were one of them, no question about it. But I think it's safe to say that episode, dramatic though it was not really related to the polar vortex that can really bring devastatingly cold air to a number of locations, including us in the midwinter. So it's a different phenomenon.
Hmm. Fred, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in too with your weather climate questions. The number to call 1-800-642-1234, or feel free to email us a question. And hey, if you've got a good weather photo, we always love to see those as well. Just go to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Thinking back last year around this time, was northeastern Wisconsin was experiencing flooding, especially, I think, along Green Bay and Lake Michigan. Do we have any idea what lake levels and rainfalls? It pretty much, the lake levels seem to be, are they corresponding with the amount of rain that we've had?
Yeah, I looked at the lake levels this morning, and they're a little bit below what they were last year, but they're still running pretty close to the average lake levels for the last few years. So the lack of precipitation that we've been seeing around the Great Lake Basin, as I mentioned, most of Wisconsin is at least for May, was 50% below normal. Northern Minnesota is, like 10% of what normal would normally be. So they're really super dry. So the impact on the lakes, we haven't really seen a real drop yet in the lake levels, even though the precipitation is really down.
Thinking about all these years I've been on the air, and it seems like about every 10 years, either the Lake Michigan is either way too high or it's way too low.
Right. It's never just right, right?
Yeah, right. No Goldilocks zone for the lake.
Right. Oh man. Well, let's talk about severe weather. We've had, we're getting into the warmer months. Last year was a big year for hurricanes, for example. I'm forgetting now. What was the hurricane level like last year? You remember?
Yeah, I don't remember how many we had. Do you remember, John? I mean, it was a record setting.
Yeah, I don't. I thought it was something like a dozen named storms or a dozen storms that made landfall in the Atlantic Basin. Not all of them in the United States, some in other parts of land masses in the Atlantic. But it was a pretty active season, as you said, Steve. Yeah, very active season.
Yeah.
I think in some ways it did cross the line from 2005, which had something on the order of 24 named storms. I think we broke that record last year. So, that's quite a year.
Wow. Well, you know what? Let's take a call here. Susan in Racine has something for us. Susan, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thank you. I have a question about the rainfall that we get in southeastern Wisconsin, which is very little right now. But it seems like I've been living here for years, and we will get a nice green area on the radar coming towards us of rain, and other areas like Milwaukee and out west of us and even farther south in Kenosha will get the rain. But there's like this little circle over Racine County always where it doesn't rain. It like splits apart when it comes over us. And it's just the darndest thing when we're so dry here, but we've had rain everywhere else. Mm. You know, is there some type of phenomenon caused by the lake or some other thing going on that causes the rain to go around us?
Go ahead, Steve.
Yeah, I was just going to tell a story that actually literally occurred to me this morning. And I think it's related in that rainfall can become really sporadic. And so usually as it's following, moving along, a thunderstorm in particular now, where you see these differences, they can just dissipate or intensify. I was on the phone this morning talking with a colleague, and she lives in Fitchburg, which you know isn't very far from where I'm in downtown Madison right now. And in that conversation, she just said, "Wow, it's pouring," and I looked out my window and there was nothing outside, and it was just a cell moving through an area that hits one area and not another. And when you're dry, like we are this year in particular. Or actually, if you're really wet, we really pay attention to whether or not it's, raining here or not raining here and raining somewhere else.
Yeah. John, yeah, anything to throw in there?
I think Steve is hinting at exactly the principle at play here. And that is that, you tend to move into periods of time when you're sort of hyper vigilant about when it's raining and when it isn't. And as he said, this relatively dry period, I think has got everybody on edge. Because I've had the exact same impression as the caller has. Most recently, it happened yesterday. My son lives in Middleton, and it was raining like crazy there. And he said, "Wow, it was pouring when I left home." And I said, "We didn't get anything." So I had this frustrating, moment. But that's the way that it sometimes goes. And in addition, the lake maybe provides on marginal days a little bit of a push back to the west of where the rain is actually going to be most dramatic. In and around Racine. So there is maybe some lake effect, but I think it's mostly the fact that, as Steve points out, the weather's thunderstorm activity especially is widely distributed in intensity and location. And so you can just miss on a number of days in a row, seeming to defy logic, but it actually is just the way the cards fall.
Yeah, well, late yesterday afternoon, it was just pouring at my place. The rain was just coming down in buckets.
Yeah.
And I'm sure it was a mile away. They weren't getting anything, so there you have it. Oh, man, John Martin and Steve Ackerman, our guests today, they'll be with us till 12:30. We'll take a quick look at the news, find out what else is in store for us. Then you can join in. Give a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Well, this year's spring so far has been dry with a mix of unusually high temperatures. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network, talking with our weather guys about weather and climate, John Martin and Steve Ackerman. John is a former chair and current faculty member in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW. Steve Ackerman, Vice Chancellor for Research and Graduate Education at the UW-Madison, also a professor in that Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. So what spring weather questions do you have? What do you want to know about the weather and climate in Wisconsin? Give a call at 800-642-1234 or email us your question and maybe your weather photo to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. A listener emailed to say as of last Friday, Lake Michigan was down 17 inches from last May's record high. That's a huge drop, exacerbated by below normal precips as well as a very mild start to winter, which meant above average evaporation. Despite the drop, lake levels are still about 18 inches above the 100-year average and 4 feet above the all-time monthly low, and that was set back in 1964. Pretty cool information there. We're still above on the lake. Lisa in Trempealeau emailed about above average temperatures, which have now been updated to be 1990 to 2020. Why do they only cover 30 years? How much of a difference would the average be if it covered the time period since temperatures have been recorded? That's an interesting
question. So that's a really good question. And you know, typically we do 30 years because that's a good statistical number to kind of, deal with anomalous years. But we also do keep 100 and not just 100-year record, but a record going back to when we first started making good instrument records of temperature. And then we compare those 30-year averages with that longer 100-120 year average to look at how this current climate period is comparing with the longer time series.
Okay, so that's the keep track of all that.
Yeah.
Michael in Bear Valley has something for us. Hi, Michael.
Hi. I have a historical question about weather forecasting. I'm very much interested in Great Lakes shipwrecks, and I know there was an awful lot of them, especially in the 1860s through the 1890s, and I was wondering what kind of weather forecasting was available to captains of ships as they were leaving ports. What sort of access did they have to forecasting?
Almost none until about 1870. That's when President Grant established the Signal Service. And the very first maritime forecast of all time was issued from Milwaukee by Increase Lapham. And that was November of 1871, I believe. And that was probably a forecast that was probably the first time it was ever of value from any sort of government agency in the United States. And I don't know if I know the story behind the story on that, whether or not that forecast proved beneficial to the mariners of the day or of the week. But I think that it did. So they got off to a pretty good start with the Signal Service making a forecast.
Steve, you've had a special interest in kind of the Great Lakes, shipwrecks, at least the Edmund Fitzgerald, but go ahead and comment.
So, for the Edmund Fitzgerald, the storm that sank the Edmund Fitzgerald on November 10th, 1975, you know, there have been a similar storm prior to that. I'm trying to remember the year now. It'll come to me, as well as a year after that, a couple of years after that, in 1998. Very, very similar storm. Oh, the 1940 storm, almost a state storm. But it was almost exactly the same. And the only difference between those three storms in terms of the deaths that occurred on the lake was the forecast. By 1998, the forecast had gotten a lot better, and there was a lot of heads up in terms of recognition of the storm developing and forecasting that to let maritime folks know that this storm was coming. And we really didn't have that even in 1975, let alone 1940.
That's really correct.
Interesting. Yeah, Michael, did you have something else there? I'm sorry.
Curious, you know, during the period where there were, you know, the big sailing ships, the schooners were carrying a lot of cargo, late 1800s, mid 1800s. What sort of did the ship captains have any kind of resources other than just sticking their finger up in the air to figure out where the storms are coming from?
I would venture to say they had experience and a network amongst themselves of great experience, which probably counted for something. But the nature of these storms, as Steve points out, the nature of these things are they're so dramatic and so quick to develop that, you know, using old rules of thumb or sort of just, you know, your own experience from being at the helm of a ship for many years is really not going to do you very much good in the face of a rapidly developing extratropical cyclone for which you did not prepare. So it's it really is a matter of forecasting technology. We live in a revolutionary era compared to what even was true 50 years ago, as Steve points out. And there's just no way that those poor people going out to sea or going out deep into the lakes in the 1880s through the 1950s really had any protection at all compared to like what we have now.
Yeah, and once they left port, there was probably very little ways to communicate unless they happened to be passing another ship that was on the lake at the same time. But
That's amazing. Michael, thanks again. I appreciate it very much. You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or email us to ideas at WPR.org. I want to go back to hurricanes for a minute. Are there predictions for hurricanes this year, the season? And when is the season, anyway? It's
the season stretches from what is it, May 1st to November 1st now, or the June 1st to November 1st?
It's still June 1st, although we've had 7 years in a row now where the first named storm has been prior to June 1st, but it's still June 1st to November. Yeah.
And what are they predicting?
They're predicting again another above normal season, not anything like the previous year. But they're predicting between 13 and 20 named storms in the coming year. And I think the average is maybe 10 or so a little bit above normal. And we've already had the first one, the first hurricane. Anna developed, I think, just a few days ago, right? May 22nd, maybe?
So how do they predict, how do they make these predictions? They're not sticking their finger up in the air to test the wind.
They do sort of modern version. There's a statistical bunch of rules that they're using to make these forecasts. I think the biggest one is whether or not there's an El Nino in the Pacific, because that really hammers Atlantic tropical storms. If there's a strong El Nino, then Atlantic tropical storms for that season suffer greatly. And so that's kind of what's going on this year. There's an absence of one. And so that allows room for the development of a slightly larger than normal number of storms. But I don't think it's much more sophisticated than a couple of predictors like that.
Hmm. And what's the, do they have a rating system? What's the rating system for hurricanes?
The Saffir-Simpson scale is a scale of intensity. There's been debate around that, whether or not we ought to do it more like we do with tornadoes, which is rate them after we notice the damage they do. The problem with that is many storms don't make landfall, and you'd like to keep track of how intense they are. So the Steve can comment better than I can about the satellite revolution that's really allowed us to have greater insight into intensity, even when the storms are remote.
Yeah. So we because of the satellite observations, we could see them, you know, when they're way out on the oceans and make measurements and categorize them in terms of the Simpson scale. I'd be cautious to get rid of that now because, you know, people got used to what a Category 4 hurricane is in terms of the forecast. And so if we waited until after the storm went by, it might be really hard to communicate to the people living along that coast that a really big storm is coming at you.
I agree with you.
But that doesn't say you shouldn't go refine it maybe afterwards.
Yeah, I very much agree with you. I think this talk is I'm not talking about the only one of those aspects, too, that's being under revision. But I agree. I think there's a lot of value to having something people are already familiar with, and especially something that talks about the current and prior conditions, not post conditions.
Yeah. And we get sort of the remnants of hurricanes once in a while up here, don't we?
We can get precipitation. The moisture from that storm can get, you know, sucked up through the Gulf. Get up from the Gulf Stream up the Mississippi Valley up our way and make it humid up here. Or in some cases, the outflow then leads to subsidence that might affect reducing precipitation in our area. So on the large scale, they can, but the storms don't quite make it up here in terms of precipitation, precipitation.
As Steve points out, we've had brushes with some of the tropical moisture and turned into precipitation. I think that August 2010 flood that we had in parts of the Gays Mills and other parts of the state was really directly related to a tropical cyclone that made landfall in Texas. But it wasn't the storm. It was just the plume of moisture that was associated with it.
Oh, interesting. So hurricanes, so we'll get some a little effect once in a while from hurricanes, or maybe even a big effect like that one. But the thing that I think bothers people more are the tornadoes.
Yeah.
And that kind of weather. And what is our tornadoes? I guess we've had tornadoes in pretty much every month, haven't we? But there's really a season for tornadoes.
Yeah, we've had tornadoes in every month except February. But otherwise, we've had it every month. And the season is starting right around now. Because of the low-level moisture that we have during the springtime and the summer, and then the upper-level winds, where unlike in hurricanes, in severe storms that are going to generate tornadoes, we want a wind shift with height in both speed and direction, so that can kind of add spin to the storm.
Yeah, and as we think right now, okay, we're getting started, but what is the most likely concern here in terms of severe weather at this this month and right now? Wind, so high winds?
Go ahead, John, and then I'll tell you what I think.
I might not be responding to the question in quite the right way, but I'd say that further south of us is where the tornado season is really revving up, and they're reaching their peak, you know, in southern Illinois, Kentucky, parts of the tornado alley, canonical tornado alley, right around now. This really gets scary at this time of year for them. It moves further north later on in the season, so I think we have more of a risk in July and August, maybe middle to late June as well. But we have our own little problem with so-called derechos, which are straight-line wind storms, and they become really prevalent in the northern Midwest in late June to early July. So we have to worry about those, and parts of the Tornado Alley don't really have much concern with those types of events. So it's almost an ugly trade-off.
Yeah, so where I was going with this is the more immediate situation where we're really dry right now. And so I was wondering, in terms of what I would really worry about within the next couple of weeks, is if we had a really heavy rainfall event. And because we're so dry, would the soil be able to take that on? Or would we get flash flooding is what how I interpreted that question, Larry.
I was looking at the forecast for southern Wisconsin, for example, for tomorrow, and it's isolated severe storms with local flooding possible.
Possible, right?
And also up to 60-mile-an-hour winds.
Yikes.
Which is why I brought up wind as what to be concerned about. 60 miles an hour, derechos, those are a lot more than 60, aren't they?
Yeah, they can be 80 to 120. They can be really substantial winds. I mean, the kind that'll rip the paint off the side of your house.
Oh. Jim from Appleton says, in honor of Bob Dylan's birthday today, you don't need weather experts to tell you which way the wind is blowing.
Yeah, you do need them to tell you what it means.
Or what it's going to be tomorrow.
Right. Oh, man. I love that. Thanks, Jim. That's right. He's Bob Dylan's 80 today. Oh, man. Well, on your blog, you wrote about the calculation of the average weather conditions over a 30-year period established by NOAA. And so what do they do? Do they take how do they do that? Let's put it that way.
Yeah, you know, in some situations, it's pretty easy, right? So in Madison, for example, you know, we're making measurements every hour, and they can average that up over a day and then average that up over a month. And you can do it in Milwaukee in a variety of seasons. So in my mind, that's pretty straightforward. What I find really interesting is then how they distribute that data statistically across the state and across the nation, right? Because we don't have observations at every single city, town, location in the country. And so they have to develop really rigorous statistical models in order to distribute that data across the continental United States. And in some, you know, in some areas, I think like in Wisconsin, southern Wisconsin, where the land is pretty uniform, probably not too challenging. But when you get to the mountainous regions, the Rocky Mountains, you know, where you have a lot of variability, not just in the ground type or the height of the ground, but also the vegetation, also makes it really challenging to figure that out, I think.
Yeah, very definitely. You know,
go ahead, John.
Picking on one aspect of that problem in the West is that how much snow falls in the high terrain. We don't really know. We have a few observations every year, and you make the best guess you can based on runoff, but it's really not precise. And it's yet extremely important for, like, the Imperial Valley or other parts of California.
And well, I guess the good news is that as long as you're consistent in how you do that over the, you know, 100, 120-year record, then you're consistent in terms of looking at what the differences are, even if you don't have a specific measurement in a specific location.
Yeah. I had... thinking back in my college career, I think I had 5 statistics courses, but and I was pretty good, but I would not be the one that the Weather Bureau would be asking to figure this all out. The statistical rigor for something like this would be absolutely amazing. What kind of climate What are the trends that we're seeing climate-wise in the report? I guess, is it really we're getting warmer?
Yeah, we're definitely getting warmer. And it's humans that are affecting that because of burning of fossil fuels. And then because of that, we're seeing other changes, the warming of streams and lakes, as an example. And then also, I was just reading an article about post-forest fires. So once a forest, you know, big fire goes through and wipes out the vegetation in that area, because the climate has changed the types of vegetation and trees that now move into that area is now different, is also changing. So I've always looked at trees. We know that particular trees like particular climates, and so the trees south of us are tending to move, but I've always thought of that as a slow process. But with forest fires, it can be a fast process, apparently.
Man. Wow, I hadn't thought of that.
And as another little nugget, I heard about the new update on the climate average, that 99% of the United States has increased its temperature since the last update. 99%. Yeah. So that's pretty amazing. Pretty damning, too. It's really pointing in one direction only.
Yeah.
Well, that's a happy note.
Yeah, I was just thinking the same thing, you know. Can we change the tone here about talk about weather and how great that's going to be tomorrow throughout Wisconsin? And maybe you'll get some rain to alleviate the dryness that you're currently feeling.
And really, it looks like
if we really face this problem as the smart people that we are in this country and in the world, we can solve it. If we keep on forgetting about it and blowing it off, It is scary. It's not a nice note. But I like every piece of information that's true, I want to hear it.
Right. Yeah. Well, I do as well. And as I look, at least over the next week, it looks like we're going to get some rain around across a good chunk of Wisconsin, a bit of it anyway. And so on that happy note, which is a happy one, I'll say thanks.
As long as it doesn't occur on the picnic over the weekend.
Yeah. Or my daughter's commencement on Sunday, right. Which is to be outside.
Right.
Oh, thanks, Steve and John. Appreciate it very much. Oh, man. Steve Ackerman, John Martin. John, professor. Steve's a professor, too. He's also vice chancellor for research and grad education at UW-Madison. And they're both a part of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. Always great to have them come by. And they'll be back again the last Monday of next month. We get some unique insight into caring for the animals at the zoo. We've got a veterinarian tomorrow from the Henry Vilas Zoo in Madison. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller.